you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Well, we got to get down to business.
This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show as I speak. Friday, April 24th, 2020 is the date. Of course, you're listening to it anytime. As I always do with a bonus guest, I ask my distinguished guest to introduce him or herself. Distinguished guest, take it away. Introduce yourself.
Thank you very much for having me. My name is Miles Camp Laffin. I am the web editor at In These Times magazine and writer, freelancer, sometimes radio guest as well. I'm very happy to be here on the Ben Jarofsky Show.
Miles is a regular guest on our show. In the old days when you're in the studio, every Thursday at 1:30, Miles would be our guest. Since we moved to the attic with the coronavirus pandemic, we've sort of blown up the schedule. It's a miracle we're doing any of these things.
Work smart, not hard. Yeah.
So sometimes Miles on Thursday, sometimes he's on Sunday, whatever. If you love Miles and our listeners love Miles, you're going to get him. Just pay attention. And you'll find them, right, Miles?
That's right. And, I'll push all these interviews out on my social media as well. So, you can always find me there.
Yeah, because I think people are used to you in that certain routine. But all routines have been shattered. All right, I have a whole list of things I want to talk to Miles about. Miles is one of our most consistent leftist guest, and that he speaks in many ways for a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters when he comes on the show. He was very adamant in his support for Bernie. So a lot of our listeners like to hear what you have to say, Miles, about the ongoing election, about Joe Biden. Is he staying true to the Democratic values, about what's the proper way to confront Donald Trump. So I have a whole list of things to talk about. We even a local issue from now to time to time. Miles, born and raised in Chicago, went to Whitney Young High School. So he's got some thoughts about how Lori Lightfoot's running the city. So we'll get into Joe Biden, Michelle Goldberg's take on Joe Biden. We'll get into Trump's handling of the coronavirus. Is interesting suggestion that people try disinfectants to battle coronavirus. We'll talk about what's going on Wisconsin, a big march today by anti-coronavirus activists. Not quite sure what to call them, pro-Trump, MAGA hat wearers. Let's just be honest what they were. But before I do any of that, I'm going to have you put your bull's hat on and just briefly talk about the thing that I'm utterly obsessed with, and that is The Last Dance, which is the movie about my beloved Chicago Bulls. People may not know this about Miles. He's a big sports fan. So what's your take so far on the Bulls documentary?
Well, one of the last big public events I went to before our current lockdown days was actually my first Bulls game of this past season that has now been truncated. So that was the last time I was really around tons of people with that, a Bulls game. It was a very sorry affair and, a world away from the era that is documented in The Last Dance. But as you said, I grew up in Chicago. I grew up loving the Bulls. I went to games that classic 97-98 season that is profiled there. And even watching, this pretty tired crew of, third stringers, basically, that were starting for the Bulls for their 2020 team. When you go to the United Center and you hear that Alan Parsons Project song come on for the intros. I think it's called Sirius, but you know, that piano synthy intro, there's really nothing like it. You know, it just immediately sends you right back. Of course, you don't, you know, these days you don't hear from North Carolina 6'6", Michael Jordan. You know, hear the cast of whoever they've got playing for him now.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that. I don't mean to trash the Bulls too much right now, because, you know, they did do this pretty big move, which has been the primary fan demand for a long time, which is fire Gar Foreman and John Paxson. And, you know, they basically did that. They've got this new guy in from Denver, Arturas, and he says he's going to be shaking up things and probably cleaning house. So I think there is some hope for us committed Bulls fans. But for anybody, even if you're not a big sports fan, there's just, you know, finally this, something to look forward to, for one, and that, you know, for the next, what, five Sundays, we're going to see, you know, new content in these episodes. But it's also, you know, it's pretty incredible to think about. This was an iconic sports team that was world-renowned, that really put, I think, you know, maybe NBA into the global phenomenon it is, and made Chicago, you know, the global metropolis it is in so many ways, was that Bulls team. And to think how sports have this major societal effect. I don't know if that's the ESPN documentaries, like the OJ one, really did go into a lot of the societal ramifications of the concept of the theory. I don't know if they're going to be careful about it, but even if just straight exists, I think it's, you know, enlightening for everybody to, like, look at how this happened, how the Chicago Bulls really changed the landscape of sports, not just America, but our globe. So for me, the Bulls, I think you understand very something about it, especially in the fact that we rarely see all the other.
Yeah, I, when you were talking about entering the United Center, really, I think you were hitting a right on target. Just the Bulls have been so bad for so long, with one or two years where they, like, had a glimmer of hope. There was that one great year in 2011. But that one constant, the Jordan statue, the introduction, the lights going down, you're in the building that Jordan built, basically. And you're right. I think the Bulls have been milking that baby for a long time. And I think that's part of the reason why attendance was so great until this year, where the last 2 years that they finally, the attendance started falling, which is probably why they decided to make the change. I think they would have, if that place was selling out, they would have just staggered along with Gar Foreman forever. But anyway, just to let people know, full Bulls talk. We're going to, I'm making this commitment every week for the next 10 weeks. I'll have at least one just Bulls discussion, Bulls conversation. The first one I dropped earlier this week, Kevin Blackstone, an old friend of mine and great sports writer. We were talking about the Bulls in the old days. And I think we're going to bring Steve James on, directed Hoop Dreams. He'll be our next guest. So, been a lot of Bulls talk on this show. But all right, Miles, let's make the transition away from basketball to politics. And your view on, well, let's just start with the Biden campaign and Michelle Goldberg's column. I sent that to you for a reading. Michelle Goldberg, a liberal columnist for the New York Times, she supported Elizabeth Warren in the primary season, but she quickly has jumped aboard the Joe Biden bandwagon. And she wrote a column last week, which I sent to all my lefty friends, in which she was urging leftists and Bernie supporters to join the Biden team. And she was saying that you'll be pleasantly surprised by some of the positions that Biden is taking, particularly on labor issues. And you'll find that it's not such a drop off from Bernie to Biden. What was your response to that?
Well, you know, we've done at In These Times quite a bit, as you know, readers may know, listeners, In These Times has long been really labor focused publication. And that means doing a lot of in-depth coverage of the labor movement, worker organizing, specifically of, like, worker militancy within unions, the push for union democracy, all kinds of things. So it's, you know, an issue that's very near and dear to me, and something I care deeply about and really want to see reflected in the next administration, because Lord knows that this Trump Department of Labor, his entire approach has just been to try to crush working people at every step. So I do care very deep about this issue, and I think that it's going to be one of the biggest areas that next president can have an impact. So I, you know, can't say that I was not moved at all by promising things about Joe Biden's labor platform. The problem is that, you know, we ranked these platforms from all of the various candidates in a past issue of In These Times. And it might not surprise you to hear that while Joe Biden's labor platform, much better than Donald Trump's, which was, you know, and is non-existent, still paled in comparison to the plans put forward by many of the other candidates. Even people like Pete Buttigieg, you know, had much more ambitious labor platforms. So on that point in particular, I think that it's just a matter of, you know, the scope. Like, Bernie Sanders put forward a Workplace Democracy Act that would have doubled union membership in America. It would have provided the right to strike for workers, which I think is a critical thing. You know, this is something that Sarah Nelson, the flight attendants president, talks about quite a bit, and that, like, workers, if we want to revitalize the American labor movement, workers need to see the benefit of organizing. And there's no clearer way to do that than through striking, because it gets the goods, you know, and it gets employers' attention. So that was a key part of that platform put forward by Senator Sanders. And, you know, the major issue I have with the claims that Joe Biden will be much more progressive than progressives, leftists, Bernie Sanders supporters, what have you, tend to believe, is that just look at who he is surrounding himself with. I mean, that's the thing that's so troubling for me, is that just this week, Bloomberg News reported that one of Joe Biden's main economic advisors has been Larry Summers. Mm-hmm. And, you know about him, Ben. This is somebody who I would not in a million years call a champion of labor or workers' rights. It's like, Larry Summers helped, he was head of the World Bank, where he pushed all these structural adjustment programs, kind of neoliberalization, third world countries. And then in the U.S., under the Clinton administration, he pushed, helped to break up Glass-Steagall, to combine investment and commercial banking. He worked to deregulate derivatives, which was a prime cause of the 2008 financial crash. And even under Obama, he worked to make sure that the stimulus was way lower than had been recommended by so many economists. I think that Larry Summers is a real kind of, he's set his life in opposition to the very work-class movements that people like Lawrence Mitchell, who was the former head of the Economic Policy Institute, who Michelle Goldberg quotes at length in this article. You know, Mitchell has been pushing a completely opposite approach to economics and labor policy than Larry Summers has. And so if Joe Biden is getting his economic advice from Larry Summers, to me, it's a very big red flag. You know, so while I do appreciate trying to, like, look at the, you know, how Biden has been operating with a positive, in a positive light, especially considering the, you know, horror show that is the Trump administration dealing with coronavirus, I don't totally buy it, because there's just, you got to look at personnel, which is going to be so important in the next administration. It's going to be looking at who is actually staffing a potential Biden administration. And if it's people like Larry Summers, then I have a pretty dim view of what labor rights are going to look like under his administration.
Dennis, did you want
to? Yeah, Miles, I had a quick question. Now, there's a picture floating around online. You mentioned Mayor Pete, so I wanted to bring this up. There's a picture floating around online, and you need to confirm if this is an actual picture, if it's Photoshopped, of one Mayor Pete Buttigieg reading the book from Micah Utrich, Bigger Than Bernie. Is that a real picture?
I don't agree much with President Trump about, but when he talks about the scourge of fake news in our, you know, media environment, I've got to say that particular Photoshop image of Mayor Pete happily reading Micah Utrecht and Megan Day's new book. While that would be a great development, that is a big, yeah.
It was a really well done picture. I couldn't tell. Like, man, is that really? Is he really doing that,
Mayor Pete?
I mean, deep fakes are real. People, it's Photoshop is hell of a thing when it comes to trying to subvert messages. But no, I don't think Mayor Pete got a. Like a fuck, unfortunately.
Here we go. I'm going to show the picture of Ben. Here
I haven't seen this picture. We got to get Mike on the show to talk about his book.
And we can edit it out. There we can look.
Oh yeah, it's hilarious. That is so funny. I just saw the picture. We should post that on our Facebook wall. All right. When you were talking about the conflicting messages that. Advice that Biden must be getting from his various advisors, it kind of brought back memories of Barack Obama in those in that transition from being a candidate to being a president. Miles, he listened to all Democrats because all Democrats came together to support Barack Obama 2008, but when push came to shove. The lefties were frozen out, and it was Larry Summers of the world who were in the room, the Rahm Emanuels of the world who were in the room with him, counseling him. And there was just a picture I saw, a real picture, not a staged photo like the one of Mayor Pete reading Micah. But there was a real photo of a roundtable discussion that Barack Obama was having early on, and there's not a lefty in the room. And I would hope... I believe that Joe Biden will be our next president. I believe the Democrats will win. And I would hope that we would not see a repeat of this in 2021 because we will be facing a huge economic crisis. We're just seeing the start of it because of the way we were shutting down the economy. So I would hope that Joe Biden would have learned the mistakes of Obama in 2009. My concern is he doesn't view that as a mistake. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, of course. And I think that that's the fundamental issue is that this is a question of worldviews, right? And Joe Biden has said, for one, he has no empathy for young people who are dealing with, crushing student debt, decrepit job market, future of climate catastrophe, so on and so forth. He said he has no empathy for them. He also assured a group of, private hedge fund managers at a fundraiser months ago that nothing would fundamentally change under his administration. And I think that just speaks to his worldview, which is that, we want to return to normalcy, but the normalcy under, the Obama administration was a massive sea of foreclosures, which fundamentally upended the social contract in America, and saw this massive transfer of wealth from the poor to the wealthy, which is what we're seeing again now with these massive corporate bailout bills that are being passed in the wake of the, we're in the midst of the coronavirus crisis. So I don't think that you can approach a crisis like the one we're facing now with the, lens of 2009, 2010, 2011 being the good times, that we want to return to, when we don't, this is going to take very fundamental rethinking of our priorities as a country and our economy and honestly as our society. I mean, we got to start thinking, we're bailing out the cruise ship industry, with taxpayer money. Is that really the best use of our money? Does the cruise ship industry, which is serving, for almost entirely wealthy individuals, need to be bailed out? Does it need to even exist? I mean, these are the kind of questions that we need to raise. And instead, when you hear things like Joe Biden is getting his economic advice from Larry Summers, it's very troubling. I will say, though, it's not like these are the only people that he's talking to. Joe Biden's longtime economic consultant was Jared Bernstein, and it still is, advising him, and he is much more on the progressive end of the spectrum. He's not a lefty, but, he's way better than Larry Summers. Ted Kaufman was his former chief of staff, who then ended up serving out the rest of his Senate term once Biden, you know, took the VP job under Obama. And Kaufman was kind of legislated as a progressive, partially because he was completely shut out of like needing any funding because he was not planning on running again. He was just serving out a term, but he was pushing for, you know, way more financial oversight and regulation than the Biden had when Biden was in that seat. So there are some people, I think, that have Biden's ear that could push him in a more progressive direction. But the fact that it's now being reported at the same time, you know, that the Biden campaign says that they're trying to make these overtures to the progressive left in the Democratic Party, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters, AOC supporters, young people, Latinos, the working class voters, the same people that powered the Bernie Sanders campaign. You know, these are the people at Biden's camp is saying they're trying to win over. And yet they're getting advice from Larry Summers and they're not really budging on their policies. I mean, Biden announced he was going to support lowering the Medicare age from 65 to 60. That's not really going to, you know, change the healthcare system in America. And as we're seeing now with tens of millions of people out of work, when your employment is tied to your healthcare and there's an economic downturn, lose your healthcare and you know, your life is put on trial and you could potentially, you know, face devastating economic and health consequences because of that. So I think that this crisis should give us a perspective that we need to rethink how we are running these basic functions of our politics. And to me, as I, you know, have made clear, I think that things like healthcare, education, even housing should be rights and we should legislate towards that. I know that Joe Biden doesn't believe those things. But he could, you know, surround himself with people and embrace policy planks and do much more. Because you know what? The reason I say this isn't just because I want what I want, but he would be a better candidate. Mm-hmm. You know, he would have a stronger base of support behind him. He would activate people that were active in the Bernie campaign way more than he's doing now. If he came out and supported some of these things, if he announced, you know, that he had more progressive advisors, if he said, you know, I'm not going to nominate people like Larry Summers to cabinet level positions or to, you know, be my advisors or anything like that, I think that would make him a stronger candidate, especially because we saw from the exit polls, even in the states that Biden won, the voters overwhelmingly favored Medicare for all, even across the South.
Yeah.
So you can't make the point that it's going to be necessarily an electoral liability for you. I think it makes you stronger, and that's why I think it's so important that he turns that corner and we don't stand satisfied with where he's at right now.
Yeah, and as I say every time you're on the show, they're going to call him a radical socialist regardless of what he does. So he might as well be a radical socialist. And as I like to point out, I get so many fundraising appeals from the right, somehow or other I got on their mailing list, and they're already calling him a radical socialist. So, you know,
yeah.
I don't know what I can understand in a way from when you're running in a Democratic primary, his trying to position himself as the centrist, because the notion that the Democrats had, they bought into that that's what's most electable against Donald Trump. But I think things have changed a lot since those debates. I didn't buy it. Actually, I'm saying this. I'm just, Miles, I was criticizing him then when he was blasting Medicare for all. What's your analysis of the various relief measures that are coming out of Washington? There was just a second one. I believe Trump may have signed it today. I've been in recording all day, so I don't know if he signed it past the House, past the Senate, second round of stimulus for America, which has been socked by the coronavirus and closing down the economy. What's your interpretation, your analysis, if you will, Miles, of these packages?
Well, I think that what we continue to see is that in a time when the most vulnerable people in our society are being squeezed to a point that is unparalleled in most of our lifetimes, the legislation coming out of Washington is centering a very different class of people, not the people that are the frontline workers, you know, over half of which are people of color in America, not centering the people who are, you know, losing their savings, who are losing their homes even, who can't pay rent, who can't pay the bills. These are not the people that are getting the support. The bills, as you know, they've been pushed out. We saw this even in the, you know, the coronavirus bill number two, the supposed paid sick leave one, that left out, you only had to provide paid sick leave if you had between 50 and 500 employees. So any of these big corporations that have more than 500 employees, they didn't have to follow it. And small businesses that have less than 50 people didn't have to follow it. So it's such a carve out. It's almost designed to protect the very industries that are the ones that are funding the political the politicians that are writing these bills. Now, the main stimulus, the $2.2 trillion one, that could have been a Democrat written bill. The Maxine Waters in the House had a bill that would have guaranteed, I think, $2,000 a month to every American throughout the course of the crisis. There's similar legislation that has gotten more backing in the House, but that's not the bill that was debated or voted on. The bill that was debated and voted on was the Republican bill in the Senate that Mitch McConnell put forth that the Democrats then kind of tweaked, and they did win some important things like, you know, adding $600 to unemployment insurance, and even getting the meager $1,200, despite how it leaves out tons of people, including undocumented immigrants who do pay taxes. None of them got the $1,200 check. There's tons of other carve-outs as well. So there were some positive things, but we also saw a $4 trillion leveraged giveaway to corporations across the country. And the only oversight that was included in it was, you know, it's supposed to be an inspector general and, you know, some oversight team, and Congress is supposed to be able to, you know, take a look at how these funds were being dispersed by Mnuchin and the Treasury Department. And Trump immediately did a signing statement where he got rid of all that afterwards. So you could have seen that coming a mile away. This was the biggest, even more so than we saw in 2000 in the wake of the financial crisis. This is the biggest corporate giveaway in modern American history in terms of, you know, taxpayer money going towards corporate welfare. So I think it's really problematic, and it requires rethinking of how we are approaching these things and who is being centered, because right now it's just more and more money for, you know, hedge funds, for CEOs, for banks. Even the, you know, small business loan program, the Paycheck Protection Program, we saw this just the other day. There's news coming out that there was a concierge service that banks were offering for their big clients to get to the front of the line. Yeah. And meanwhile, the mom and pops aren't getting any of it. While with the money, where's the money going? It's going to Potbelly, it's going to Shake Shack, it's one of these massive retail chains and food outlets that don't really need it when small businesses can't get their hands on it. And it's already out of business. The problem is that what the U.S. government decided to do, and really the Republican Party decided to do, because they, you know, wrote the first version of the bill, was to say, we're going to incentivize people losing their jobs. And so the only way you can really get financial support is by being unemployed and then applying for unemployment insurance. So all the incentives are to not be in your job, which means these companies are going to go under. Other countries didn't do this. You know, you look in the UK, Spain, other places across the world, Sweden, Denmark, they all paid the paycheck for the employees, and that's what's going on. So they are keeping their employees on payroll. Whereas in the US, we're just saying, get rid of your employees. That's the only way they can get any support, which is so backwards. And I fear it's going to just mean we're heading towards a depression, because I can't see these people getting work again while we're still doing social distancing. So I think that there's, you know, I know it's a lot of response on the question of the stimulus bill, but I think it merits really being critical of how this whole process has unfolded. And I think Democrats really need to grow a backbone. And for this next round of stimulus, Mitch McConnell's already saying we can't pass more stimulus because the deficit. But Democrats need to say, hell no, working people are still getting screwed, and we need to do more to help them. And that includes things like a mortgage and rent freeze. That includes money for the post office, which is on the verge of going under. We need to make some really bold demands right now because Lord knows the time calls for it.
Yeah, no, it's laughable to hear Mitch McConnell suddenly talk about the budget deficit, given the policies of the Republican Party for the last 3 years of Donald Trump. Actually, their policies, whenever they're in charge, when Bush was in charge, baby Bush was in charge, it was the same way. So, yeah, it's laughable that they still, every now and then, cling to this notion about their deficit hawks when, of course, they're running up the biggest deficits of anybody. And what you're getting at, Miles, in your analysis is, well, there's two things. One, when the Republicans, there's three parts at play in these negotiations, the White House, the Senate, and the Congress. And the Congress is the only Democratic-run entity. Trump runs the White House, and McConnell runs the Senate. So the Democrats are limited in their leverage. They do have leverage, no doubt. They do have leverage, and how they exercise it going forth will determine what these bills look like. And as you pointed out, they did get some concessions in the last go-around. But two-thirds of the process is controlled by Republicans. And so this is... this is a reality that Democrats have to figure.
That's very true, and I think that's very true, and we need to remember that it's not as if the Democrats control this whole system. But the thing is, the really a troubling development for me is that what the Democrats are claiming to have won in this most recent round, this 3-point stimulus, 3.5, whatever you want to call it, the one that likely was signed today. Is that they were claiming they won funding for testing. If that's the the bargaining chip that Democrats are winning, is the thing that we just need to deal with this crisis. Like, testing is not a Democratic issue.
Yeah.
Like, Republicans need to get tested for coronavirus. It just makes no sense that the Republicans have framed it as, we'll give you we'll give you money for some money for testing, but then we get money for corporate welfare.
Yeah.
And it's like no other country, even these authoritarian countries around the world, are all pouring federal money into testing because they realize that's the only way you can start to think about reopening the economy. And here, where Republicans are not only is the White House saying we're not going to fund any more testing, and remarkably today, the Trump administration announced they are not going to be part of the WHO, the World Health Organization's efforts to create a vaccine. They said they don't want any part in it because, Trump thinks that it's, that China runs the WHO, whatever. So, we're not actually treating this as a public health crisis. We're treating it as like a political football, this issue of testing. And that is no way. I mean, you can't reopen if there's no testing, because people aren't going to feel safe going out. Even if you open up all the restaurants, it's just not going to work. And what McConnell says is the states can go bankrupt. He doesn't want any more funding for states and municipalities. Well, how are you going to reopen the economy if all the states are going bankrupt? Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. It's just, it's pure barbarity on the part of the Republican Party. And that's, I worry that the Democrats are allowing themselves to be put into this position where they brag about winning money for testing when that should be a nonpartisan issue. And what they should be winning money for is working people. And, it's something I feel very strongly about.
That is, you're right on with that. That's absolutely right on. And that'll get me to this final point I want to raise. When you get to that issue where Republicans treat testing as though it is a chit in the negotiations with the Democrats, that underscores the reality of the political dynamics going on in this country now relating to coronavirus. The Republican Party has not bought into the idea fully, Miles, that this is a serious health crisis. Today, Friday, there were 1,000 or so protesters in the streets of Madison, Wisconsin, protesting Governor Evers' shutdown order in the state of Wisconsin. And I was telling, I was showing Dennis the picture. They weren't social distancing. They weren't wearing masks. They were right on top of each other. It was like a defiant two fingers in the middle, two fingers high to all the experts who say there it is a health danger to congregate without social distancing. It's a health hazard to congregate without wearing a mask. It's a health hazard to leave the safety of your house. That's that, and the Republican Party has not forcefully denounced that movement. In fact, they're encouraging that movement. They're financing that movement. So when you say, when you point out the obvious that testing is being used as a chit in this larger negotiations in which they're going to begrudgingly give testing equipment to states like Illinois and New York, blue states, the reality is that the Republicans haven't even agreed that this is a crisis. So I don't know how the Democrats, it's almost like it's a larger existential battle they're in the middle of. Do you follow what I'm saying, Miles?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. Initially, when you referred to Wisconsin protests, you call it either, you know, anti-coronavirus activists, but actually, I think what they are, you're correct, is that they're anti-Evers. You know, they're against the Democratic governor, his social distancing orders. But I don't even think that they're necessarily against coronavirus. A lot of these people don't buy it. You know, they don't believe that, they don't just believe what's in front of them because, and we should be clear, this has, you know, been proven now. You can read about it, New York Times, other places. It's largely an AstroTurf-funded movement, is in that, you know, there's the same groups as, you know, the usual suspects in front of the Tea Party as well, the American Legislative Exchange Council, all these shadowy groups funded by the far, by far right individuals. And, you know, they work to secretly push forward far right conspiracy theories, what have you. They're funding this, but they're all real people that are coming out to these rallies that buy into it because they want to believe what they want to believe, and understandably, they don't want to see, you know, their lives offended. Now, the class makeup of it, I think these are largely kind of business owners themselves. They're not the people that are going to be. That's why when you see these iconic, photos of nurses and frontline workers blocking the protesters, it's for their own good because they want them not to congregate so that they don't get sick, because the nurses are dealing with the results of this every day in the emergency rooms. And they see that this is, you know, coronavirus is the number one cause of death in America. 50,000 people are dead. That's almost as many Americans as died in the entire Vietnam War. And this has been going on for what, for, you know, a couple months tops in terms of the real death count. This is, you know, and these are the only the people that we know of, right? Because we haven't done the testing, so we don't know the full extent of it. So there's no way you could say that this is just, you know, hawked up, fiction or anything. It's clearly driving a true public health crisis now. And even if we are nearing a peak of this wave, that still means there's at least 50% left to go of the crisis. So it's not like it's going to evaporate in one moment, but you're very right to say that these people that are protesting it are not operating, you know, as if this is a crisis to be taken seriously. They're thinking, oh, their lives are being disrupted and they're going to raise hell about it. Now, I do think that that's a very small sliver of the population that buys into that stuff. But when you have a president that's at the podium saying, you know, ingest disinfectant and try to figure out, Trump said he found out that sunlight can hurt the virus. And he wondered aloud, how can you get that under the skin? You know, it's just this kind of incredible. Imagine, like, you couldn't make that up, you know, of somebody. So when you have a person in charge of their country who's saying those things and treating and saying liberate Michigan, liberate Minnesota, what have you, and fueling this stuff, it's all wink and a nod. And they're already, Trump might have said he was being sarcastic, but Larry Hogan, governor of Maryland. Said he got over 100 people calling him that had were specifically asking which of these products are safe to ingest, amongst like Clorox and different bleach products, to the governor's office the day after Trump said this. So he might think he's being sarcastic, but he's the president, and people are watching this being broadcast live on their screens, and they're responding. So, I mean, it's pretty unreal the amount of mismanagement and ineptitude at the level of the federal government that is going on. One thing I do want to note, though, is that there was a study. I'm not, you know, by any means trying to gloat about the public, the risk that these protesters are putting themselves into, but, you know, the study that just came out from the Politico reported on yesterday that said that elderly voters and, you know, elderly right-wing voters are in these swing states are the ones that are the most vulnerable to die, and that could very well swing the election from Trump, is because of the, you know, the loss of votes that would result from the mass death in many of these swing states among his voting base. So it's really, even if you look at it from a political, like, strategic view, very foolish of him to try to put these people that are his supporters in harm's way, because we know how deadly this virus is and how quickly it kills and how that would completely upend his political fortune. Yeah. So it's, on every level, it's just complete inanity.
It's sick and it's twisted, and he's a sick, twisted man. He's the president of the United States, and he wasn't being sarcastic. I saw it, and it was one of his stream of conscious moments. And I do not wish ill on anybody. Absolutely do not wish ill on anybody. I don't care what their political views are in the larger scheme of things, but I think it's madness what Donald Trump did yesterday. And it's cowardice that the Republican Party won't stand up to him. And Miles, I say this as a guy, and I always say this, I fought the Democrat. I am Democrat to the core, but I have fought Democratic leaders in this town for 30 years on their various initiatives, which I think were ridiculous. I'm about to write an article critical of our Democratic mayor about what she just did, you know, or pulled at the city council level. I just, the cowardice on the part of the Republican Party, and with the few exceptions of right-wing core of writers, is sickening. And, you know, so I'll leave it there. Before I let you go, why don't you tell folks what you got ahead? You always got good stuff that you're working on. What are you writing? What are other writers from In These Times about to come out with? Give us a little promotion.
Yeah, of course. We have been publishing tons of great work about the coronavirus situation, the response from workers. We just put out this piece that's actually signed by a bunch of leaders, including Carl Rosen, who's the president of UE, of the United Electrical Workers, folks from Unite Here, National Union of Healthcare Workers, and the Democratic Socialists of America, all signing on to this letter. It's on In These Times website now, called Capitalism Failing Its Coronavirus Stress Test. Only workers can turn things around. And it's a real call to action to really encourage workers to embrace militancy in the face of this crisis. You know, it's kind of a response to this USA Today op-ed that other labor leaders put together, that kind of actually was cheering on how corporations have been taking the lead and stepping up. And so this is a counter approach to that, saying, you know, no, we shouldn't be cheering on corporate power. We should actually be fighting it in the streets. And a lot of great labor leaders were on that. So I encourage people to read that. We also just published, I think, a really interesting article on an issue that a lot of folks are talking about now, which is third parties, not even the Green Party necessarily, but Justin Amash from Michigan, who's an independent, has been saying he might run on a third party line, was probably through the Libertarian Party, that, as we know, could really screw up whatever happens because of this spoiler issue we have in this winner take all system in American politics. So we published this article by David Daley and Rob Ritchie, who work for a group called Fair Vote, and they really advocate for ranked choice voting, which is a very different approach. Some listeners might be familiar with it, but this piece is called "Tired of Fighting About Third Parties, Just Enact Ranked Choice Voting." That really goes in because Maine is going to be the first state in November to vote for president using ranked choice voting. New York State just voted to incorporate it. States across the country are doing it. And it really gets rid of the third party spoiler issue because the person with the least votes just gets eliminated, and then their voters get distributed to whoever that voter put for their second and third choice or what have you. So that's a really interesting piece. And I'm going to be coming out with an article next week going into a little bit more detail on the stimulus bills, how they've fallen short, and what we need, how we need Democrats to step it up. So look out for that. And I'll be watching Last Dance again on Sunday night, putting my Bulls gear on.
Get that Bulls hat on. Bulls t-shirt, Bulls hat.
It. Miles, call it right now. The playoffs would be right now. Would the Bulls be in the playoffs?
Sadly, I think that they might, like, just get, I don't think they would, honestly. I think they'd probably be in the nine, that ninth seed, but they might just get into the eighth seed and then lose every game. And then if that had happened, though, I think that the organization would be in a much worse place, because then they would have said, oh, everything's fine, we accomplished our goal, what have you. Instead, I got to say, Bulls fans who have been clamoring for fire Garpack for a long time, I know it's we're all social distancing now, but we should feel pretty excited because it actually happened.
Yeah,
and I'm a cynic. I didn't think it was going to happen. And so this could be a real new era for the Chicago Bulls, and for somebody who's watched them in a very decrepit state and begrudgingly watched these games for years and years of losing, it's kind of a hopeful experience for once.
Well, I'll just say this about my beloved Chicago Bulls. Yes, they would have made the playoffs, and yes, they would have stunned the world by defeating everyone, and they would have been the champs. And without the coronavirus, we'd have a huge celebration in Grant Park. And you know what, folks? You can't prove me wrong, because it didn't happen either way. So to quote Steve Kerr, that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Miles, thank you so much. Stay healthy, stay well, keep churning out the good stories, and we'll talk to you real soon, all right?
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Dennis. Be good. Talk to you soon.
That's a great Miles Konflas, and I'm Ben Drofsky. Take care, everyone.
See you, buddy.